it's the wind blowing in the rain, tide just rolling in and make it flood again.
Welcome to Between the Covers on KBOO Portland 97 FM. I'm your host this week, Avi Marr.
I don't know why I hear you crying out loud.
Israeli-American novelist Leora Skolkin-Smith is the author of Edges, O Israel, O Palestine, selected and edited by Grace Paley for Glad Day Books. Her other work includes The Fragile Mistress and Hystera. Edges was awarded a Penn Faulkner Writer in Schools Award and was a selection in Bloomsbury Review's 25th anniversary issue as a favorite book of the last 25 years, a National Women's Studies Association conference selection, and a Jewish Book Council selection. Her latest novel, Stealing Faith, is a story of women's lives unfurled and a friendship at once impossible and eternal. Welcome to Between the Covers, Leora Skolkin-Smith.
Hi.
Leora, you spent your childhood both in Westchester, New York, and Israel, your mother's birthplace.
Yeah.
How do you think your travels and relationship with Israel at that time affected your sense of yourself as a person and a writer?
In all total ways. It was a complete impression. And it really stayed with me. I knew that my mother came from war. She was in the Haganah, which is the Jewish underground. I knew that people had to struggle to exist. You see, and that fascinated me, even as a child. I thought that the nature of existence as an existential question was very fascinating and very compelling. And I thought these people had to struggle for just, I don't know, to use a bathroom in a museum. So I was very conscious that there could be a threat to person and psyche. And my mother was very unusual as an Israeli because she had a lot of Muslim friends. So the whole thing is something that made me feel like someone who was definitely different, but definitely different from other people.
Well, it sounds like in some ways what you're describing is like the microcosm of your family and your beliefs was one thing, but the heat of the political situation,
it followed me. It follows me now. It follows me now and breaks my heart. So the whole thing, and maybe you want to talk into how I met up with Grace Paley, that was the main thing that we connected with. That kind of otherness, if I can call it something specific, has followed me my whole life.
Well, how do you think those experiences formed the questions that you took up in your first novel, Edges?
I wanted to know who the hell I was. Mm. You know, it's as simple as that. I just wanted to know, who am I? Who am I in relation to this world and global circumstance, which is intensely important to the world? And I feel very grateful that I could have a past that is so attached to the world. And I read a lot, and I tried to figure it out. I'm not religious, so I'm not a religious Jew, and I am friend with Arabs, friend with Muslims. I do not want this situation to continue. But I do feel the existential threat of my life is something very, very real. You know what I mean? You know, I really had to deal with it in a certain kind of palpable way. So that made me a writer. Mm-hmm. That definitely made me a writer. The only way to go there is to be a writer. There's no way you're going to get through something like that if you're not.
Well, I think what I'm hearing you say is that kind of juxtaposition where it's not resolvable in a really personal way. It's not resolvable.
In a terribly personal way on both sides. Mm-hmm. You know, my Arab friends feel just as cornered and besotten and accused as I do. Mm-hmm. So I would say that in terms of writing, it's a great part of my background. It's not just I'm from France or I'm from England and I had to deal with a very crazy mother, which I'm sure after reading my book, you've really gotten the impression she was pretty nuts, but she was pretty wonderful too.
But
it sounds like part of what you're saying is that feeling of otherness, that sort of set apart.
Yes. Yes.
Kind of
that makes you a writer.
But part of made you have to describe, have to go inward.
Had to. I had to know what it was. Because the other clue to that, and I don't know if people from other countries that are at war feel the same way, but I have a feeling that they do, is that you're always being described or talked about, but nobody's ever getting it right.
Right.
So you feel this personal responsibility to get it right on your own terms in writing. You feel a personal responsibility.
Right, because you're being characterized. You feel made into
it. Yeah, you're being characterized, but you're really being stereotyped.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
My mother was really stereotyped. You know, you're just not that person.
Yeah.
So who are you? And then that question, who are you, becomes your writing life.
Yeah.
And I married a psychiatrist. So I married someone with the same questions of just, who am I?
Yeah. So the conflicts in Liana's sexual awakening and separation from the intensity of the mother-daughter relationship in Edges.
I feel that we're very afloat when it comes to how women love women.
Mm.
We see it in a very conventional, closed way.
But what questions were you interested in the family history for your character at the beginning of the book?
I was very interested in how she would deal with her father's despair about his being, how she would deal with it. Would she have a despair about her being? Would she have a question about despair in the world? And it turned out, yes, she did. And yes, I did.
Mm-hmm. So you wanted to explore the despair of the person left over when the father's despair overtakes him the way that it does.
Yes.
So while your character wrestles with the loss of her loved father, she also battles with that identification with him and his decision to end his life. Suicide and suicidality is deeply mined aspect in the book. How did you see her relationship with her lost father in her self-destructive behavior?
Well, I think she identified with him.
Hmm.
And I think she heard a voice in her head that she should die like him because she was worthless.
Mm-hmm.
Like him, and that there would never be any great joy in life. But I think she overcame that in my books.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's part of what you chose to have be her arc, is to come out of that identification.
Come out of that identification, come out of that feeling that that's all there is to life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, a certain sadness that you're not who you want to be.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very personal, and that's very close to what my real life is like.
Mm-hmm. So Allegra's a student at an elite college. She starts out both wanting the approval of and recognizing the fragile ego of one male famous writer who is her teacher.
Should I say who it is? Or? Yeah, I can't tell you how many phone calls I got after I wrote that character that said thank you. I mean, according to him, he was proof. He was one of the truly destructive males. And I'm not someone that doesn't like men, because I really love my father.
Yeah.
And I really love my husband. We've been married 30 years.
Yeah, well, it sounds like that's kind of our moment when Allegra is so vulnerable to both the negative influence of that powerful teacher and then the positive influence of sort of Faith arriving, that she's just impressionable.
As was Allegra and the year, it wasn't a time when women were known to be okay with each other as closeness. That was the whole thing I wanted to explore.
Yeah, yeah. So one of the things I love about the book is I love the way Allegra uses the concept of imprinting to talk about her relationship with Faith.
I'll tell you a real story that the book is really based on, but I didn't use the real story. When I was in seventh grade, had an English teacher. And I was a troubled kid. And I had a very difficult mother. And she was from Israel, as I explained to you. And she was very violent. And, you know, once in a while, she'd like throw me or my sister down the stairs. And it was very hard to cope with. And I had this English teacher. And she was so beautiful. She had like this beautiful blonde hair. Just all shining and glowing. and this beautiful, friendly face. And I sort of wanted her to be my mother. I was in a hospital, and I got out. And I didn't really know who I was anymore after this experience of hospitalization, which I don't mind talking about as a person. I didn't know who I was. But I remember this one woman. And she was the key to my identity. Because when I remembered her, I remembered who I was, what I looked like, what I liked back then. She came to New York to see that I wasn't and kind of put pieces together for me. And that with this imprint came identity. Mm-hmm. And it became fascinating to me as a person and as a writer.
Right. So that relationship between an imprint that you took in and your identity is what you're really describing.
Yeah. I really didn't know who I was. It's a very devastating place. I don't mind coming out and saying that. And I don't mind using myself as an example to say that.
But I do like the way you talked about it as like a mapping on the brain itself, you know, as mm-hmm. an almost physical use of another person.
But I also imprinted on Grace Kelly.
You did.
I also, to this day, when I'm insecure about my work, mostly, or myself, I think of Grace. What would Grace say? Oh. And you know what she always said to me?
What she always said?
You're as good as any of them. Oh. I just thought that was such an incredible thing to say.
Well, I mean, I think that was one of my questions or one of my commentaries on your book is one of the things you speak about in such a lovely way.
Thank
is
you.
The way that she was an ally rather than, because someone could enjoy sort of being godlike. Yeah, and I think that's something that really comes through in the novel is to be mentored by someone who doesn't need to be above you. Allegra inwardly battles what she calls her dark states and hopes that the imprinting can win out and save her from the dark states. It's a perfect way to describe the power of a teacher, trusted elder. Did you feel supported like that in your life?
Grace Paley really supported me. I guess I don't mind. You know, my husband and I always have discussions. Are you going to ever come out that you were in a hospital, that you tried to kill yourself and all this stuff? And I said, you know, look, I don't mind if it helps someone. That you can get well. But you need these figures.
One of the things that's so comforting about the book is that you see, I don't know what we'd call it, a mentor, an elder, a role model, a beautiful writer, you know, a grounded, beautiful human being come into a young woman's life and help organize her by how she shows up.
Well, I think I'm older than most. So for me, relationships that are close with women were very verboten in my age growing up. It was like really suspect.
So is part of what you're saying and part of what you're teaching me is, because I like what you're opening up about the topic of how women were allowed to care about each other.
Not much.
Decades,
not much.
And that there had to be a kind of a formality or it was suspect. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. It was just overwhelming. And I'm 71. So I really go back. And I couldn't understand the depth of the feelings, the intensity of the feelings, so intense to need a mother. When I got to the hospital, I saw people in the same desperation.
Yeah.
The same, and it's like such a needed topic.
Well, it sounds like part of what you're exploring in the book is the sort of mystery of what is being cared for and what is being taken care of.
Yeah.
And what is needing versus fusing with someone and where it works in a positive way to sort of be a life raft.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's really a figure inside an imprint.
Mm-hmm. An imprint.
In other words, like one example would be if you're prone to self-hatred, you would say to yourself, I'm not talented. Mm-hmm. So let's say the figure would say, no, you're like Grace. You're as good as any of them. Yeah. That would be an imprint.
And you have to give the person the power to believe them and to take in the love that they're offering. That's what it sounds like that you show us with Allegra and Faith that is.
It's very fraught. It's very fraught.
Say that again.
Fraught.
It's really fraught.
Yeah, it's fraught.
Yeah. Well, it sounds, I mean, the word I'd use, it's a very primal love. So
it's a very primal love. That's it.
So it's That's before exactly. we form into yeah. categories. It's before we put yeah. it into the category
you
of.
You don't even have any categories. Yeah. And you don't know what it is. You don't know what's hitting you. It's enormous.
Right. Well, and it also sounds like it's being in touch with your own need and desire to survive.
It's really true. And you can emotionally die without a figure. And you asked about my mother in Israel. Yeah. What that did to me, what Israel did to me was take away a mother.
That history.
I have a mother. It gave me a history. It gave me a sense of war.
It gave you me mean what it did to your what the raging
the war did to my mother.
Israel did to your mother?
And what it did to my mother. Made her hard. And unforgiving. And brutal.
It made her brutal.
Made her brutal. Uh-huh. Yeah. Uh-huh. War would do that.
Yeah. 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 So there's this way that it seems like the novel, it's helping me understand sort of the melancholy and the despair that's almost before the novel begins. Yeah.
I've wrestled with it. Was it chemical? I mean, how come I felt despair and my friend didn't? Yeah. You know, maybe some of that was chemical. Some of that was just not having a mother growing up.
Yeah. Yeah.
And always needing and knowing that need was there. Mm-hmm. And in a really pulsing, direct, you know, completely compulsive way.
Yeah.
I have to get this fixed. Uh-huh. I have to get this fixed. So I have to friend this person. This person has to mother me. And that can be very off-putting to people.
Well, I mean, I think part of what we're talking about in the novel is that you see it successfully happen.
Yeah, because Grace was so great. Because
and so many people
Grace Kelly character was so open to it because she got it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because she really got it. Mm-hmm. But I mean, she probably thought the world needed a mother.
Mm-hmm.
That was probably her answer to a lot of questions.
This is KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. If you're just joining us, our guest today is novelist Leora Skolkin-Smith.
So in the novel, in the earlier part of it, Faith kind of betrays Allegra.
Yeah.
Do you feel like that kind of love and seeking comfort in the other is unsustainable? Is that how you made the choice to have?
No, I tell you, fame is a hard mistress. Mm-hmm. Fame is hard.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I don't think it was Faith's fault. She became very famous.
Yeah.
Therefore, millions of people were always surrounding her. Therefore, it was very hard to get close to her. Therefore, it was very hard to say, well, no, she's mine. You couldn't say that because she was a famous person. So
she was everybody's, yeah.
Yeah, she was everybody's, and who are you? And, you know, all that whole idea of fame is very interesting to me in the new novel that I'm concocting. Because I grew up in a lot of fame. My father was entertainment lawyer.
Oh, so you were around the entertainment industry.
I was in the entertainment industry. He represented Marlon Brando, Fellini. You know, so I was always at the cutting edge of, I don't know if cutting edge is the right word, the sword
mm-hmm.
always went into me because he always represented people who were not bigger than people. And who the hell would I know about them? But they were my father's clients. So I was very comfortable with Faith and Grace Paley on one hand because I'd been brought up like that. But I mean, that woman knew everyone. I mean, my God, she knew Nobel Prize winners. I mean, they would just flood her. And also there was something, I don't have a better word for it, so I'll use the word charismatic. But she was an incredibly charismatic individual.
People were magnetized to her.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. To an almost sickening degree.
So how did you come to make the choice to have someone, to have Faith in the novel, write about Allegra's story? How did you come to decide to have this kind of idealized character then sort of sell out Allegra's story? That's what I'm asking about.
I wanted to show how close Grace herself got to selling out. And I really needed a fictional imaginative device to get there. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to show, because she was dangerously close, often, selling out herself.
Is that what you were saying about fame being a harsh mistress?
I think it's always inviting
you to sell out? Is that what you're saying?
I think it's always inviting you to sell out, yes. Mm. Or it's always making you feel like you're not good enough. So it was very easy for me, given my father's experiences like that, fetch lawyer board. You know, and Carol Channing, I mean, if she planted a kiss on my cheek, it was like supposed to be sacred. Or something. I was supposed to feel like I was in the Queen's. You know, so I grew up very rebellious, very hardcore rebellious. Huh. And I still am. I really hated Reagan. I really hated the whole Reagan era.
Really?
The whole I am famous, I am, you know, the goddess of whatever this is or whatever that is. I grew up very rebellious against that. But I wanted to give that to Faith. I wanted to do it in a fiction where I could show a person caught up in that and seduced by that.
Oh, and selling someone out because of
it. Selling someone out, almost selling someone out.
Almost, yeah. Because it seems like that's a pivotal part of the book, is Allegra's downward spiral after idealizing and imprinting on Faith. It kind of breaks her.
Yeah, it breaks her. Yeah. And that must come from childhood. That must come from all the times I felt really broken by my father's clients, or that I didn't understand. Like, my best friend was Hillary Cosell. Her father was Howard Cosell. You know, and I didn't understand why I was supposed to bow in the presence of this person when he was so loud and obnoxious.
I see what you're saying.
You know, like in my new book, which is more about Howard Cosell, it's almost a political stance that I took. Like, we don't have kings or queens, but we have celebrities. And I have so much anger and so much fury, so much, you know, what you did to my father. You made him want to kill himself because he wasn't good enough. You know, and look at what you did. So all that went into stealing Faith.
I see. So the kind of hierarchies that get set up.
Hierarchies, yeah. Yeah, you got to have a natural antipathy towards it.
But it also gave you this amazing depth of the exploration between Faith and Allegra.
What it makes me say is, I wish you knew Grace Paley.
Everyone wishes they knew Grace Paley.
Wonderful, as everyone says. She really was. And that was the other challenge. She died, and there were all these tributes. It had all this, like, solemn, phony stuff.
Yeah.
And I felt a real responsibility to bring the earthy Grace that I knew and loved into the world, so that everyone could go and love her and know why she was so great. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think it was her empathy. Mm-hmm. The tremendousness of her empathy towards other people. And that's what made her writing so great.
Well, and I also think it's one of the ways that you know, in a fictionalized account, you really showed someone who could be that much of a titan of literature, like undeniable talent, but at the same time, sort of excessively human.
Unbelievably human, and falling apart all the time herself, falling into depression herself. Mm. But you know, she was really worried about the world in a way I haven't met in any other person. She was really worried about the world, and she was worried about women.
Yeah.
And she was very hurt by the feminism that wasn't there in her day. She was very hurt by it. And I'm sure she was called a lot of things and dismissed a lot of times. Virginia Woolf, too, I would say, who I spoke to Grace about. Uh-huh. Virginia Woolf's own writing about herself.
Yeah.
It's just so much that feeling. Mm-hmm. And so much what writing was about. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Much of the novel unfolds as Allegra's life in the hospital itself, both the violence of institutionalization and its effect on Allegra's mind and body. How do you understand Allegra's kind of twin impulses, which you speak about so beautifully, both to write and to end her life, because they seem like these twin forces.
What a great question. You're a good questioner. That's a great question. That is the question. Mm-hmm. That is the question. That's what's before her. Could she end her life, or can she live it by writing? Mm-hmm. Because when she wrote, she felt a repair, and she felt a presence. That is the question.
Can you say more about that? When she wrote, she felt a repair.
I still feel it when I write. You know, like, for example, if I wrote about my mother, which I do often, mm-hmm. I feel a repair. I feel like, oh, I'm understanding her. Mm-hmm. So I can understand that aggression against me. Most of the hardest things, not now, because it's 30 years after the fact. I mean, I haven't been in a hospital for 30 years, and I'm, you know, I'm really one of the most normal people walking around God's earth. Mm-hmm. But to take your own life is a very scary thing. It's a very harrowing experience, mm-hmm. to be so close to want death. Mm-hmm. You know, and either it breaks you and you do it, mm-hmm. or it makes you a writer. That's just how I looked at it. Or a philosopher or a therapist. Maybe a therapist. Yeah.
Well, what is it about the writing that sort of, what would be a way to speak about it? It transmutes all of the questions into a, it helps you take ownership of the questions. It helps sew you together. How would you?
I had a very interesting discussion. Whoever. Go ahead. Yeah, I had a very interesting discussion with my husband last night. Mm-hmm. Because I was being interviewed. And we talked about Van Gogh.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And I said, Van Gogh would tell you to look at his blue, to look at his strokes. And that will tell you why he didn't kill himself. Because he could make those strokes.
Oh.
And there's no easy answer there. There's no psychobabble there. Transformative.
Right.
Van Gogh could not tell you why. He could make that turbulence. He lived that day. He didn't cut off his ear that day.
Mm-hmm.
And with me, the same. Mm-hmm. Not my ear, but I could live that day. And I, to this day, I don't know. That I thank my father and mother. There I do thank my mother, because she came from a country where she had to face life and death so blindly and so in your face.
Yeah.
That either she did something about it, which in her, she went around, actually, my mother went around trying to get things for Palestinians in her later life. But it has to affect you when you see that much death. It has to affect you when you know that life is that fragile, is that instantaneously gone. And what it means when it's instantaneously gone is nothing, just blank, just black.
It's to create meaning where you feel the meaninglessness,
yes.
of all that.
There
violence.
You go. There you go. That's why you're a psychologist. Yes. That's to create meaning. So you can see your meaning and you can feel validated.
Yeah.
Yeah. It means something. It symbolizes something. Mm-hmm. That's what that's what I meant. Yeah.
Yeah.
And also to create presence.
This is KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. If you're just joining us, our guest today is novelist Leora Skolkin-Smith.
You have to remember that suicidal people are caught in invisibility. They're caught in a belief that they don't matter and that they're invisible anyway, so they should die. So when they write, it's like, oh, there I am. That's me. They can recognize a self. They can recognize a body. They can recognize a voice. Grace was very big on voice. And it's no mystery that so many of the poets that were big on voice were suicidal. I'm thinking of Sophia Plath and Anne Sexton and so many more that came after them.
Uh-huh.
It was either write or die.
So when Allegra is in the hospital and Faith, she comes to visit, it's how good a writer Allegra is, how important what she has to say is. And that to me sounded like this sort of golden thread that pulled Allegra through all this darkness.
You got it. Yeah. I matter. Mm-hmm. I matter. I have meaning. Mm-hmm. Because under the domain of her mother, she didn't matter. Find her hypersexual.
The mother?
Yeah. Because I think that's one of the things that really messed up Allegra.
Oh, say more about that.
Because, I mean, that was one of the things I had trouble writing about. But I see a psychoanalyst. So the mother was very close to my body. Be close to my body. I mean, you're talking about edges when they're lying on the couch.
Yeah, yeah.
Being close to my flesh. Mm-hmm. That can cause unwanted orgasm. That can cause a real freak out in a young girl.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's one of the ways that Allegra is made so you ground the character so much is in her physical responses.
You don't know who you are, what those feelings are.
Well, it also really speaks to how you characterized how trustworthy Faith was. She was so trustworthy that she could hold whatever didn't make sense to Allegra, but was pouring out of her without any alarm.
I'm really flattered and I'm really touched that you got my book. Yeah. Yeah, that's my book.
Yeah, that combination of how primal the love and need was with how, what a safe space it was.
Someone who was enough like her mother to cure her of her mother.
Eventually, Allegra takes the lifeline that Faith offers. It's such an extreme form of support. Being brought into herself by this generative act of devotion. Did that fictionalized scenario reflect the level of support you felt from Grace Palin?
Even go so far in my dark periods, I would call Grace and say, I want to die and talk about it. And one thing I would say for people who have had suicidal states is they need to talk about it. There I go being the worst enemy of this interview.
Is a profound level of support. Be it in the way you beautifully characterized it in a work of fiction, or what fuels that from your own innate knowledge, from being supported to that extent, I think, you know.
It's also visceral. It's just visceral. Doesn't have to be, you know, oh, was it sexual?
Yeah,
was
it, names you, for it. Yeah.
You can throw all those words out and just say that it was a visceral, human, and mental, and physical reaction to somebody who fulfilled a mother longing, who fulfilled a longing.
Well, and I think the repair in the book, right, the way Faith apologizes, takes complete ownership, and tries to repair it, I think it's the same way of describing being held, that she held this young woman in mind in a way that was reparative to her.
Yeah, and I was very conscious because of my age of how out of line that was in terms of what women can do for each other. I think now it's not a shocker.
Yeah, I do think you are describing a historical way of
hysterical,
being.
Yeah. I mean, you couldn't even say when I was growing up, you couldn't even say that someone was your best friend without thinking someone that you were sleeping with. The roles had to be very, very, very definite between man and woman.
Oh.
Father goes to work. Mother, home, does laundry.
Mm-hmm.
The roles were so tight and so choking that the body just, you know, went nuts. You know, that's really what I think. The role, the social roles were not like they are now. And you did not talk about loving another woman. My God. You know, that was, you know, absolutely the most forbidden of forbiddens. Or a man loving another man, but not sexually.
But I think you're making such a good point about the decade within, or the time frame within this book, and part of Allegra's despair is this sort of cookie cutter world she's walking into, where she's having these overwhelming depressive or dark feelings, and she has no map at all, given how tightly the roles were.
Yeah, she has no map. You know, she's all feeling, yeah. But the thing is that Grace filled that thing in her, that thing, that poetic thing that Van Gogh would know what I'm talking about, his stroke, his blue stroke.
Yeah.
You know, Grace made those blue strokes for her, Grace. And she could acknowledge them and feel them and take them in her body.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's a very unusual thing, I think, isn't it?
It was rare. I think it's still rare. I think that we're still unclear about those boundaries. We still need a push in the direction of, yes, you can love another woman. Yeah. For one reason or another, I needed another woman in my life.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think part of what you're saying is it's not demonized anymore to have a level of closeness where you can support each other.
And you can have like the mother you didn't have, or the sister you didn't, with Carolyn, it's like the sister, you know, we both had terrible sisters, and, you know, we both had terrible mothers, and, you know, we're like, and I just thought, if anyone read our email, my God. You know, Carolyn, she's very effusive. Yeah, yeah. But it was like, I love you, sweetheart. And I think that Grace Paley was instrumental, not only for me, but for many women for a decade.
As a role model for how to...
As a role model for opening up the love between women. I don't think you could even write about your mother if you were a woman in her day.
Say more about that.
Whenever I wrote in Grace's class, because I was so obsessed with my mother, because my mother's like such an obsession of mine, and she's so dramatic from Israel and all this stuff. Grace was always like wide-eyed about it. Because mostly she'd get male-female love relationships. And she wouldn't get mother-daughter. And she was very close with her daughter. Grace was. They were very close. And she was very close with their mother.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know where her feminism came from. You know, she was divorced. And Grace was not a Vogue model. You know, she was probably dismissed 100 times as a housewife.
Mm.
From all that pain of dismissal and pain and invisibility, she grew the strength of voice, of voice, of voice, and from the Bronx.
Mm-hmm.
Well, even though her father was a doctor. Nobody knows that about Grace. Very few people know that about Grace. But people think, oh, Grace's father must have been a plumber.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But no, he was a doctor.
Uh-huh.
She had this undying sense of unfairness towards people who didn't have money, people who were in the wrong class,
yeah,
people who loved women, who were women loving women.
This is KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. If you're just joining us, our guest today is novelist Leora Skolkin-Smith. So she was like a natural advocate, you're saying?
Oh, yeah. I think she was a very important person. She refused to dismiss people's work. And all of us got dismissed. Because all of us, pretty much from Sarah Lawrence, were young girls. So we were all going to write about the same unimportant experiences. And what Grace did, which was the most important thing for me, was to make a woman's experience important. Just as important as a man going to war. That there was an equality to that.
So what kind of questions preoccupy you now as you write?
The same. Uh-huh. But right now I'm very preoccupied with Israel. I'm very preoccupied with larger questions about the world. You know, war and peace, and why.
So back around to the same existential questions, huh?
The same existential questions about boundaries, I think.
Yeah.
Why do we have to have these definitions? And why do we have to go to war like this? Mm. I'm very upset about Israel. Very, very upset.
It's really full circle. I mean, it sounds like what you witnessed when you were a child and you were so...
She was amazing, my mother.
Yeah.
They were all amazing. They were so, if you think about it, they weren't even allowed to exist. But we don't even know what that feels like. The existential wealth of questions was always, and my father was a depressive, so the existential wealth of questions was always my domain as a writer.
How did your mother come to live in the U.S.?
Oh, it's very weird. My mother, everything with my mother was very weird because she was very good looking, apparently. Not as an adult, but young. And she had lots of boyfriends. And so it was in the middle of a war. My father was sent by Roosevelt. Roosevelt said, go to Columbia University Law School and pick two student lawyers and send mm-hmm. them to Jerusalem to represent us. Hey. And my father was one of the student lawyers. And he was sent by Roosevelt to my grandfather's house, who my grandfather turned out to be a big deal. Okay, I can say that in Israel. He was like
your mother's father.
Yeah, my mother's father is a really big deal. It's a really big deal to be an original in Israel. It's not, it's a class system. It's not like in America where it's really about money if you're a big deal or fame or something. In Israel, it's really birth. And both grandfather and grandmother were from Palestine. They were very big deals. My grandfather had the first grocery store. Mm-hmm. So Roosevelt said, send two young, my father wasn't a big deal. He was just a law student at Columbia, two lawyers. And so they fell in love. But I think she basically wanted to get out of Israel. Great dog.
So then you were born over here.
I was born over there, but I was taken over there every 3 years. Yeah. And you ask about my new book, and a lot of it is about that. And when I was a little girl, I was taken to the boundaries of the old city and not allowed to go in.
Oh, really? Huh. So you were there before all the lines were drawn.
Before all the lines were drawn, yeah.
That's an amazing historical knowledge you carry.
Yeah, so I always have those questions, and they're always historical, and they're always larger than the person.
And so, and it continues to preoccupy you even now with how you're going to...
All the time.
You grew
I became
up
a mother.
Reality
I became so much like her. It's really frightening. I'm a fighter. Yeah. Look how I fight for mental illness. You know, that was my fight.
But I'll fight for it tooth and nail. Boy, I'll get down on the ground and shout for you.
Yeah.
I have that fighting in me with my mother. You have to really fight.
That it would have been so easy to just give up.
To be mentally ill. Would have been so much easier to just be mentally ill.
Institutionalized, just to be.
Yeah, be institutionalized, and that's your life. And for a lot of people, you know, it is.
Right. Right.
A lot of people never get out of that whole prison. I'm very vehement for Middle East peace, and I'm very vehement for psychiatry. I'm very vehement that we get our act together
when it comes to
mental health. Yeah, we stop doing this to people. Because I saw a lot of cruelty in the hospital. And I saw a lot of cruelty when I got that.
Yeah.
Terrible cruelty.
Well, it sounds like, you know, one of the things you've been doing battle with and sort of from that aspect of yourself is being invalidated, whether it's you or someone else. You just...
I guess so. I guess that's my thing. Yeah. I guess that's my thing. I don't know why. Yeah.
But it also sounds like you're giving your complicated mother credit.
In the end, my mother became one of my greatest role models. But I tell you, as a mother, forget it.
But it does sound like that's one of the things that Stealing Faith really makes room for, is the complexity of something can be so damaging in some way, and in another way, it's part of what helps you pull yourself out.
Love that you feel. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. I really do.
It's very hopeful for other people and for...
I one thing in my, I don't know, self, I really would like mental illness to not be used the way it's used. So it's time to come out there with a book and say, look, this I did, and this you can do, and you can get over it. And you don't have to be mentally ill. That doesn't have to be the label that you carry for the rest of your life. I would really love that.
Well, I think one of the gifts that you give in the book is to speak to it from a voice so deep inside of the psyche of one young person that it really is, I think, helps you make room for not being so alone with those kinds of thoughts and feelings.
Thank you. One of the things I really loved about. Appreciate it. Mm-hmm. I really appreciate it. I really do. It makes me happy.
Good. Well, it's been an absolute joy to talk to you, Leora. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I really can't thank you enough. I was just in the dog garden saying, gee, what is my life about now? You know, and then I thought, well, this is so nice to share this with you. Thank you.
Of course.
It's the wind blowing in the rain.
That's our show for today. Thanks for listening to Between the Covers here on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Original music from Karen Talui.
Hiding in the clouds, I don't know why, I hear you crying out loud.